But I should say hello to Dr. Sam Jones, our vet.
Good morning. How are you going? I'm great. Thanks, Kate.
And you're right at home here because you've been the ECHA vet previously, haven't you?
Yeah, I was the vet
one
at the for a couple of years. Yeah.
I imagine they need a team.
No, actually, it would just be one vet. This is when I worked for the University of Queensland as one of the veterinarians out at Daybra, and we'd sort of do it on a rotational basis. And you have to sleep here. So, you know, there's a little vet quarters.
Yes.
It was fairly modest. And, of course, you know, you're on call the whole time because anything can happen at any stage.
And you've got to be right on your game because I'm thinking on site at the moment there would be chooks and all manner of bird-like competition animals. There's horses, which we all know want to just axe themselves whenever they can.
Absolutely.
And so you have to be right across that.
They can be flighty.
There's the dogs and the cats, but there's also over the back at the moment still, I think, the bison, because they've been doing the show. So, you know,
it's a very broad range of animals you've got to look after.
If you've got to call up about the bison,
what are you going to do?
What are you going to
do? Well, look, I had a bull once that it's this enormous bull. I think it was about... It was about sort of 1,600 kilos or something. It was massive. And I had to try and pass a tube down his throat, essentially, to relieve some gas. And it was quite a challenge, let me tell you. He sort of threw me around a little bit, and then we we changed tact a little bit and had to try something different. So, you know, you never know what sort of challenges you're going to be presented with when you're at the ECHA working as the vet, because there is such a broad range of animals. I remember once, too, I had to deliver some lambs in front of a pavilion full of people. You know, this ewe just started lambing, and those lambs had to come out right there and then.
Right.
So it was great. You know, these people got to experience the joy of these lambs being born.
That messy miracle.
Yeah. Yeah. So that was really interesting. They loved it, of course, you know, and it was great to be able to share that with them.
You know, I was thinking that it would be difficult for some of the animals here. I was headed out. It was after the night show that happens, which was pretty spectacular. And the kids were all knackered, and we went through the ride section to head out of sight. Before we did, we had a little tour around where the cows live and the chooks as well. And I just thought, wonder if the chooks are used to all of that loud noise, like the screaming of people on the rides and the kind of amp up music and stuff like that.
No.
Does that stress them out?
It would. It would stress them out. I mean, here's the thing. If you take any animals and remove them from their natural environment or the environment that they're familiar with, there will always be some element of stress. And so, you know, the caretakers of these animals go to great lengths to try and make it as comfortable as possible. You know, ensuring that there's adequate space for cattle, for example, to be able to lie down and move around. Certainly, adequate ventilation is a big one. And so they go to quite a lot of effort to make sure that they're comfortable. There are some things that are unavoidable, like the noise, you know, and until they invent earplugs for chickens, unfortunately the chickens do have to sort of bear the brunt of that that noise of the ECHA. But, you know, it's like any animal that you remove if you move house or if you get a new cat, for example, you know, the first thing you do with a new cat is you put it into a room so it can be on its own, explore that immediate environment before letting it out to the rest of the house. And that way the cat can feel more secure and comfortable. You've got to give them somewhere to hide away, whether it be a little cat igloo, and certainly something to climb, like a cat castle or something, where they can get up nice and high and feel secure. So there's lots of things you can do, depending on the species, to make them feel secure.
And the cows would have been here for the week before as well. So they haven't just landed in the middle of the chaos.
That's right.
They had a week to get used to it. And
exactly.
Then it starts to build up
exactly.
In intensity after that. On ABC Radio Brisbane and Queensland, Kate O'Toole's my name. Dr. Sam Jones is here. He's from my local vet, but he can be your vet today if you'd like to call 1300 222 612. Of course, we'll be having general discussions, so you may well need to seek your own medical advice, but we can kind of get you started on some ideas, perhaps 1300 222 612 or text 0467 922 612. We're talking about stress in animals in a different environment. Tamara has a question on the text line about anxiety in general. How do you help a very anxious dog? Are dogs prone to being, you know, you can just have an anxious type?
Well, we're seeing a lot of anxiety in dogs now, even from very young ages, you know, like 8 to 10 weeks. It's quite amazing.
Is there a correlation that we also see anxiety in humans?
Definitely. I mean, this is the thing, is that it's not uncommon for me to have a client that walk through the door, you know, clutching their little dog, saying, "She's very anxious." And I'm sort of like, yeah, you know, they feed off your own anxiety.
Yeah.
And just like kids, you know, it's the same thing with kids. They will sense a parent's anxiety, and then they will think to themselves, "Oh, is there something to be anxious about?" And it's a natural thing. So dogs are very perceptive that way.
Not always the case, though, is it, either?
Because No.
I have one horse that's very anxious, and then another one that just couldn't care less about anything.
Yeah, look, it's probably similar to humans. There's probably a genetic component, certainly an environmental component.
Yeah.
And there's things you can do to try and reduce anxiety. So the question, the lady was asking about, you know, is there particular individuals that are just anxious, or a breed or whatnot? It really depends on what the source of the anxiety is in terms of how you would handle it. So you've got to try and identify, okay, what are the triggers? Okay, mm-hmm. And then try and avoid those in the first place, if possible, because the less stimulus that pet has to become anxious, the less anxious they'll be, the less sort of familiar that behaviour becomes to them.
Oh, it's a spiral.
Yeah, so you don't want...
They train it effectively, do they? Well, they train themselves into anxiety.
More or less. And, okay. and so what you ideally would do is say, okay, if you identify what the stimulus is, then you expose them to that stimulus at a very low sort of volume, you know. Let's say something that would make a dog anxious. Well, my dog gets anxious. If I've got him, say, when I had a ute, he'd be in the back of the ute and I'd go into the shops to get something, he would start barking, but he'd develop this separation anxiety. And so what I needed to do with him was get him used to being, you know, 2 metres away from him, and then praise him and reward him for that. And then I could gradually move further and further away until he got more and more comfortable with it, and giving him positive reinforcement for not barking and getting stressed out each time I increased the distance.
So you reduced the anxiety level in your dog by doing that, by rewarding him and saying it'll be okay and you'll get a treat in a minute, basically, and you're just, you know.
Well, yeah, but you've got to be careful that you don't inadvertently reward negative behaviour. So, if, for example, you don't want to go giving them treats preemptively, saying, oh, here's a treat, this will distract you from being anxious, because the pet will typically feel anxious and get rewarded for that. You know, they get the treat and feel like, okay, well, this is the right thing to do, so to speak. So you really do just need to kind of look for the opportunities and create that opportunity for them to do the quote-unquote right behaviour, that is, not bark, not become overly anxious, reward them for those behaviours, and gradually build up and sort of expose them to what it was that was making them anxious in the first place, and just increase the intensity of it.
It just would be easier if there was a pill, though.
Yes.
Well, I mean, the training sounds very, like, you know, painstaking and slow.
It is painstaking and it is slow. And, you know, you've got to have the commitment to your pet to help them in that regard. And, of course, there are anti-anxiety medications for pets. We do use them, but we don't just reach for them reflexively. You know, veterinarians, if you bring in your pet and you say, look, you know, she's got separation anxiety or some other sort of anxiety, we're not just going to say, oh, look, here's a tablet, because that's actually not the answer. You know, it might help them out in the short term, but it's not the long-term answer.
On ABC Radio Brisbane and Queensland, Kate O'Toole's my name. Dr. Sam Jones is here. He is a vet and he's keen to talk about whatever you want, basically. Angela on the Gold Coast wanted to talk about her Staffy, a 12-year-old male Staffy. He's always been a bit of a sook and a bit whiny, and he kind of wants to talk like Staffies sometimes do. And she asks, at his age, what sign would I be looking for indicating pain or discomfort? Because he's always been a little bit whiny. How do I know that there's something behind it?
That's a really good question, Angela, because when you're looking to identify pain in dogs, you know, in their home environment, they don't typically cry. The only sort of times I really hear about dogs crying at home is when they've got spinal or neck pain, and then they'll scream. And sometimes if you sort of feel their abdomen, a dog might kind of whimper if they've got a really painful abdomen. But the vast majority of the time, the pain presents in a very, very subtle way. And that might just be that the pet is more subdued, you know, is not behaving their normal self. And in actual fact, there's plenty of times where dogs are in pain that's it's it's impossible to even perceive that they're in pain. Like dental pain, for example, is insidious and it's not overt. Dogs will be running around, wagging their tail, eating and drinking, and they will have significant dental pain, or they can have significant dental pain, which is only identified through annual dentistry and taking x-rays of their mouth. Now, one great sort of point I should make here is that a lot of people will bring their dog into me and say, oh, look, he's limping, but he's not in pain, or he's holding his paw up, but I don't think he's painful. Well, when a dog holds their paw up, unless they're trained to do so and they're waving or begging for food or something, but typically when they're holding their paw up, that is because they're painful. That is the most common reason for a dog to be holding their paw off the ground. And so then when we do our systematic kind of examination of that limb, we typically will find an area, a focal area of pain.
Would the client have the that misunderstanding that's not pain because they've palpated a bit and there hasn't been a big yelp or response? Or why would they think that it's not painful?
Oh, I don't know. I honestly don't know the answer to that question, because to me it's obvious, but I don't judge them, because I've been a vet for, you know, 16 years, and to me it's second nature. Okay, dog's holding up its paw, it's most likely painful. But I think a lot of people just think that they, you know, I don't know, they hold their paw up for other reasons, but it's definitely almost always pain related when they're holding up a paw. So the crying and the whimpering thing is actually much less common. The subtle signs are much more common. And I should just point out, elderly dogs, you know, older dogs with arthritis, and a lot of, like almost all of them, will develop arthritis at some stage later in life. Those signs can be as subtle as just reluctant to jump in the car, or he doesn't seem to want to run up the stairs anymore. You know, slow to get up, slow to get down. You know, when a dog kind of circles around and then kind of settles?
Yeah.
That can be a sign of joint pain. So that's how subtle it can be. Yeah, and then the way to identify that is when you go to your veterinarian and you mention these things, they'll do a musculoskeletal exam, and they'll literally flex and extend these joints to try and see, okay, what is the range of motion and how comfortable is this pet with me doing this examination?
So for someone like Angela with an older staffy, is it just about having those regular catch-ups with the vet to sort of double-check?
It is. Absolutely. And you know, and then they can have that conversation with you and say, okay, these are the flags to look for, the subtle hints at home. If they don't find anything on physical examination, these are the things to look for. When they start to happen, there's actually really wonderful medications now that we can use almost preemptively, like the earliest sign that we've got degenerative joint disease or arthritis, we can start giving medications now that will actually really slow down the progression of that disease process, which is wonderful for our pets. It gives them longevity. So
it's interesting to think about that those signs would be so subtle. But then I was thinking that sometimes in people it's like that too. You might not realise actually that you are sort of subconsciously making decisions to change the way that you move your body, because your body is starting to get limited in some way or has some little tightness or soreness, and then you start to change, and then the whole it's very interesting, isn't it? Hi, Dr. Sam says, Rachel, I have a 6-year-old miniature lilac merle border doodle who constantly has smelly ears. Any suggestions?
Lilac merle, Rachel, sounds like a beautiful dog.
I don't know, is this, but there's also a suggestion here about I've heard that putting turmeric down will help, and I feel like Rachel might be having a joke, because you can't put turmeric in a dog's ears, can you?
Not that I'm aware of.
No.
I don't think there is a sort of a liquid turmeric that would be appropriate to put in a dog's ear. And if she has smelly ears, I can tell you now, just based on experience, she almost certainly has an ear infection of some description.
Okay.
You know, that dog's ears don't really smell. They shouldn't smell.
Yeah.
And, you know, I've had people bring sort of dogs to me and say, oh, yeah, you know, I might say, oh, I look at the ear, I might see that it looks a little bit dirty, and which would then prompt an otoscopic examination with the instrument to look down the dog's ear. And I'll ask the question, you know, does he shake his head? And they'll say, oh, yeah, but he's done that forever. You know, sure enough, I look down the ear and he's got an ear infection. I say, okay, well, let's take a sample of that material that's down the ear, the gunk, you know, put it onto a glass slide, look at it, stain it up, look at it under the microscope to identify what sort of pathogen we've got there. And often they'll have a yeast infection in Queensland. We've got a lot of allergic dogs, and it's very humid most of the year. And so, you know, it's a very common thing for us to see these yeast overgrowths, right, in dogs' ears, which are itchy.
Right.
But a lot of people don't recognise, oh, it's actually abnormal for them to be shaking their head, right? A shake here and there is fine. So if your dog, Rachel, has smelly ears, I would take him to your veterinarian and they will almost certainly do an otoscopic examination, and then they should take a sample, stain it up, look at it under the microscope, identify if there's pathogens there, and if there are, then you would use, you know, an appropriate medication to treat that ear infection, just like you would in a human.
22 minutes past 11 on ABC Radio Brisbane and Queensland. Kate O'Toole's my name, and you're hearing from Dr. Sam Jones, who's a vet, and he's answering your questions today. This is a really interesting one, and this person hasn't put their name on the text. Do put your name on the text if you can, because I love to know who we're talking to. This person's saying, we have a seven-year-old Australian bulldog, and we're trying to get the bulldog out of our bedroom because we're expecting a baby after 15 years. But the further along the pregnancy goes, the more he doesn't like being away from me. I'm the pregnant one. Is this normal as a bulldog be, this person concedes, but also says, is it a normal thing when pregnant? And he's been getting anxious at night as well. He was doing really well until this last week or so. This is at 19 weeks of the pregnancy, so still a long way to go. Pets and pregnancy, an interesting can of worms to open, I think.
Oh, it's amazing what our pets can perceive, you know. And I just remember, you know, our 12-year-old Labrador Digby, when my wife Jane was pregnant with Archie, he's now four, he's our first child, and he did really cling, especially in later pregnancy. He became sort of, you know, had this real proximity seeking with Jane, and wanted to, especially when we're out and about. I noticed that, and I've heard lots of anecdotes from clients of, you know, the dog being more protective and this sort of thing. So it's just a beautiful, natural thing to happen, you know, the way I see it. And now, in terms of this particular situation with your beautiful bulldog, I think that the way to manage the scenario where, you know, he's getting anxious at night time because you're wanting to transition him out of the bedroom, and how are you going to go about doing that? The best way, I think, to do that would be to crate train him in your bedroom initially. So in other words, you buy a crate, and you've got to get one that's an appropriate size for him to be able to sort of go up one end and settle and rest and sleep, and kind of walk down the other end and have a drink and something to eat, right? So it needs to be the right size. Anyway, that's in your bedroom. Start off with it in your bedroom. And then I would just gradually move it out of the bedroom, you know, initially with the door open, then in the hallway. And so that way he's actually feeling, once he's nice and comfortable and secure in that own micro environment, if you like, he's in his little crate. A crate is definitely not the sort of environment you want to make it. It's not a punishment, right? You have to sort of have them go in of their own volition. So you feed them in the crate, you know, and they get their treats in the crate, and their toys are in the crate. It's this beautiful place, a sanctuary for them.
So you're talking about multiple times a day or just at night time?
No, you can do it multiple times a day. Yeah. Typically, when we were crate training Digby, when he was a puppy, and this is a bit of a different scenario, we might put him in sort of three or four times over the course of 24 hours. But he would definitely sleep in it overnight. Mm-hmm. That's the important thing. And you close the door, right? But initially, the door's just open. And you just, once you're getting them used to it, you're just throwing treats in there, and they're going in of their own volition and coming out when they want. And then, I would move that crate then out of the room and then down the hallway and then gradually, you know, into another room. And then you'll find, I think, that you'll put him to bed in his crate. He'll be happy. He'll be secure because he's used to that environment. He's comfortable with it.
Excellent. Well, all the best with that. And I think, that idea, we can look at it in more detail. I'm sure many people listening would have stories to contribute. We might do that in more detail at another time. Maria just wanted to contribute something, I think, to get feedback on it being a good thing to do. She said that she used to have a brush that slipped over her finger to clean her cat's teeth. It was bought from a pet store, and the cat would be sort of okay with it if rewarded with liver treats as part of the whole deal. She still had her annual scale and clean, but her understanding was that the brushing slowed the plaque build-up.
Exactly.
Is that the idea?
Yeah, Maria, you're absolutely correct, and it is the gold standard for preventative healthcare. Preventative dental health care for your cat at home. You know, brushing the teeth, whether you use one of those little finger brushes, and they're pretty handy. I guess the only challenge sometimes is getting your whole finger, you know, into your pet's mouth. But it sounds like you've done a great job with your cat there. And that is going to be the best thing to slow down the accumulation of plaque on your cat's teeth. And I should just point out, it's important to brush your dog's teeth. If you've got dogs, brush your dog's teeth as well. And they do make specific you know, cat and dog toothpaste. Don't use human toothpaste. You've got to use specific pet toothpaste. And it's got to be done daily. It's no point doing it every 3 days or once a week, right? The bacteria that's in the mouth will kind of calcify and form a cement, if you like, on those teeth within 24 hours. So you've got to be doing it every day in order to kind of, you know, stay ahead of the curve, so to speak, and remove that sludge before it turns into a really hard cement on the teeth.
Okay, so that's, you're saddling up to quite a task there.
Look, it's not for everyone. Some people don't have the time nor the will, and also maybe some pets won't tolerate it, you know? So it's, you've got to sort of pick your battles, I suppose. But definitely if you can... You can train pets to tolerate it. You don't just dive in with a toothbrush and hope for the best, you know. What you've got to do is introduce them to the toothpaste first, let them lick it, give them a treat for even being interested, and then you gradually, over a period of days to weeks, work up to brushing the teeth. But it might go from just letting them lick the toothpaste, good boy, good girl, and then you might, you know, the next step might be just having them tolerate it, just having the toothbrush sitting in their cheek cavity, you know, just on the outside of their teeth, even just for 2 seconds. And then it's a treat for that. And then you move to the next stage, which is moving the brush around. And I might just point out, I wouldn't try and brush the inside of the teeth, you know, where the tongue touches that. So that's going to result in somewhat of a tooth brushing circus, if you like.
What's an appropriate treat for Dr. Sam Jones after doing an excellent session of Vet Talk Back? I just want to train you to have positive associations.
Thanks so much.
I do have a half of a scone here from my discussion with... A half of a scone.
You know, I'm happy with that. Beggars can't be choosers, Kate.
Yeah, okay. Well, good boy.
So
kind
of you.
Dr. Sam Jones, vet here on ABC Radio Brisbane and Queensland. He's from My Local Vet, but just helping you out today. And thank you so much for your questions as well.